Welcome, everyone. You've tuned in to Paradigm Shifters, and we have a person who is a wonderful paradigm shifter. He's moving through all kinds of levels of consciousness in this lifetime and helping a lot of people. And in many ways, he's shifting people's paradigms, people's way of being, people's limitations through the voice. He's also an actor and has quite an amazing history as an actor. He comes from the Webber Douglas Academy in London, but also you helped pioneer Shakespeare's Globe Theatre. That's a pretty big job to do right there. Welcome to the show, Stuart Pearce.
Well, thank you. Thank you, thank you, thank you, thank you. It's wonderful to be here talking about what one is passionate about to an interesting, wonderfully volatile individual. So thank you for inviting me, Veronica. This is wonderful.
Well, this is going to be very delightful. And what people don't know is that you've been an actor and you were a very successful actor. And then your career through some, well, it's not serendipity, but through it was time. Introduced you as a voice coach, but that led you to a huge career in itself. And I'll bet you also still act, do you?
No. That was something that finished.
Okay. Well, I always believe that the voice is an amazing tool, and you can tell people's resonance, people's inner trials, tribulations, and potentials just through the sound of their voice. Can you not?
Oh, completely. Absolutely. And in fact, in ancient times, when I say ancient times, really going back into past civilizations, whether that be Atlantis or Egypt or Rome or Greece, that the human voice was always used as a barometer, as a gradation device to read the sincerity, the truth, the trust, the integrity of the human being.
Oh, really?
In Rome, it was called persona, of course, which literally persona, which we derive the word personality or the word person. I just want to apologize for a moment if I sound a bit croaky. It's just that I've had a very bad cold. However, the word persona is really just describing the inner essence or the soul of the individual. But of course, the word persona means per through sona sound. And so we speak of persona, persona grata or persona non grata. And in fact, the word is still used because we talk about personality or post 9/11, when many of our political refugees, our Islamic terrorists, whatever, were being imprisoned in Guantanamo Bay.
Ah,
they were referred to as being non
persona non grata, right?
Their voices were taken.
Mm-hmm.
They were persona non grata. Non persons, the American vernacular called them non persons. So their voices were taken from them. So, yes, our voices are absolutely crucial in terms of the integration of the physical, emotional, mental, and spiritual energies of our beings. And in fact, sound is at the very core of creation for the planet and for ourselves. So we each have a note, we each have a resonance, we each have a sonic evaluation system, so to speak.
Well, I know, Stuart, you are also an intuitive. Is this, for example, is that the kind of work you did before you were a voice coach? Did you already work with the personal resonances? And I know also you're an angel whisperer, aren't you? Someone who brings angels through to understand the value of a person's journey and so on. Is that right? Is it all connected? And have you done that most of your life?
Well, it's all connected, but like most of us who are of a certain age, because we're both in our 60s, and forgive me, you may be slightly older, but I see us as being of similar generation, that childhood was not an easy playground for the transmission of spiritual intelligence.
It was not.
And what we know, I believe, both of us, although we haven't shared this until this moment, that we had the ability to see. I was fully in connection with the multidimensional universe, and I thought everybody saw what I saw and felt and perceived. I talked about it to soon discover that wasn't true. And so, 3D consciousness comes crashing in. I found it very difficult to process educational merit. So that meant that I couldn't read before the age of 14. I was numerically dyslexic. We now know that I'm synesthetic. Then in the post.
So am I, actually.
So there we are, you see? We sober. And in fact, there are many people out there who are not outed as synesthetes, but there are many, many people who are synesthete. I'm saying that simply because although we use it as a cachet, I don't feel there's anything remarkable about it. It's just that we've had difficulty through our incarnational pathway to marry the schisms in life. And the one particular schism that we're identifying is the way that we are from a spiritual, intuitive, or psychic point of view, and the way that the world conducts itself. And there's a huge schism still about that. Less so now than 50, 60 years ago. But you and I both know it's still there. So to answer your question, or just to finalize answering your question, the trajectory that you now see me living has been an organic developmental process. Did I see angels as a child? Sure. But I didn't start talking to them formally until this group that I work with, the Angels of Atlantis, came to me in 1987 during the Harmonic Convergence. Now, did I go out to meet them? No. I was just simply reading for people in a wonderful town called Glastonbury in Wiltshire, which is the heart chakra of the world, because it was I was told that it was the harmonic convergence. I didn't really know what that meant. I knew it was a unique astrological configuration. But then this event...
Are you also an astrologer? Sorry, don't mean to interrupt you, but I do mean to.
No, I'm an intelligent person who asks questions, so I wouldn't say I'm an astrologer, but we know that the stars have an immense resonance on our planetary lives. Mm-hmm. The harmonic convergence was immensely important for a grand trine that was established. And the ancient Mayan peoples, or the ancient Mayan philosophy, said that 144,000 rainbow-like warriors would be released. Well, I was just humbly reading for people because, you know, this epicenter that I've described, Glastonbury in Wiltshire in the United Kingdom, many people from all over the world had descended on the town, and I was reading, and then I felt exhausted and went and sat on the hill, which is known as Glastonbury Tor, T-O-R, and had this divine transmission where 12 angels came and spoke to me. So that's when I really woke up to the prophecy or promise of the angel's virtue.
That's kind of an exalted awakening, isn't it? 12 angels standing there talking to you. I'm like, well, I like that.
Yeah, well, actually floating more. I've always seen angels as orbs. I've never seen them as human beings with wings, although I think human beings with wings are lovely. But they've always come to me as orbs since I was a child.
Oh.
And so I was very bemused by the fact that I was introduced to them, even though I'd always seen them as orbs of light, that they were suddenly human beings with wings when I, you know, grew to recognizing consciousness that that's what they were.
Well, tell me this, were those orbs colored?
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah.
Is that how you designated which was which identity, angel identity?
Well, not the first thing that designated their identity was the sound that they emitted,
mm-hmm.
These extraordinary harmonics, which I tried to capture with my own voice in the recording that is called the Angel Soul Calls of the Angels of Atlantis, where I've made recordings for each angel in some of the unique sacred chambers of the world, like the King's Chamber of the Great Pyramid, for example.
How wonderful. I haven't listened to that. I will.
Mm. And then, of course, having heard the sound and the searing content of their transmission, which moved through my heart chakra, rather like a burning sword, I opened my eyes in startlement to see in front of me these 12 huge orbs. I mean, very, very big, 6-7 feet in diameter, way off, floating in the air.
Wow, wonderful. Wow.
Yeah.
Did they speak with you? Could you speak with them?
So they started to speak through my consciousness. And each voice was unique. And there are 12, the four greats, of course. I say the four greats because they're most common, Michael, Gabriel, Raphael, and Uriel. But then other angels, such as Raziel and Safkiel and Zadkiel, and they all have very unique roles, which has been identified in Kabbalah. But they've gone on to identify themselves for me. So they each represent the 12 keys to the universal resonance frequency. They overshadow the 12 Melchizedek, the 12 of the White Brotherhood or the Intergalactic Council. Mm. They're known in Kabbalah as the Malakim, this group of angels that are the saving grace of the Malkai Zedek. Uh-huh. The Malkai Zedek are the priest kings or the priest queens. We see Malkai Zedek as Melchizedek, but actually there are 12. So they're, you know, it's rather like listening to Esther Hicks describe Abraham, that we see Abraham as being singular, but of course Abraham actually is made up of many entities. And so the angels of Atlantis come as this summit conference, this group entity. They appear to have individual persona, to use the word here again, but they're actually one force, really.
Wow. So it's like a coalescence.
It's a coalescence, yeah, mm-hmm. yeah. And they hold a ring pass knot that was very powerfully used during the 250,000 years or whatever of the length and breadth of the Atlantean civilization, and now come forth to reconnect us with the virtue and the verities of how life was lived in ancient Atlantis and then in some of the other ancient civilizations, such as ancient Egypt, where, as you know, I spend a tremendous amount of time, and Greece and Rome.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's very interesting. I want to ask you a kind of a basic question, Stuart. What do you see our journey as a collective on humanity? You mentioned Atlantis, we mentioned the pyramids and so on. And I often have these connections with huge, I haven't been to the pyramids for a long, long time, but I have a huge connection between the pyramids and a lot of Greek temples and so on, and have a very big awareness of having been schooled through this system. And I'm watching humanity, and I wondered, for example, from what am I trying to say? What is the flow of human consciousness? Are we learning to unlimit ourselves? Are we trying to follow a system as it is? Are we trying to break a system, break totally out of it, and become a freer group of individuals or freer species? What can you give us kind of an overview?
Gosh, all of that.
All of the above, huh?
Well, firstly, I start off with our origin, what appears to me to be our origin, which of course is given to me by these supernatural beings that work with me.
Right.
That we are actually star beings who know the cosmos extraordinarily well in the ancient part of our souls, and yet have decided through this incarnatory pathway that we're engaged in as human beings, as Homo sapiens, we have decided to come to planet Earth at this time to witness one of the most remarkable evolutionary processes that planet Earth, the great Gaia, has ever been through. And so, yes, I believe that as we go through this awakening process, at the moment I believe that we're in the middle of a vortex of a spiritual revolution, we're waking up to the enormous potential that we actually have within us, that our soul can bring to the physiological nature of what it is to be Homo sapiens. You know, I believe fundamentally that there is a reason for why the 44 codons of DNA is asleep or are asleep, are dormant within our bodies, that we're only living 20 of the 64 potential. Mm. And that what's happening at this moment is that we're moving from a double helix into a triple helix with the possibility of transmuting even further during these life capacities, depending, of course, on two very simple aspects of our soul psychology. Number one, that thought creates reality, and that what we need to do is to be vigilant about what we're thinking so that we can bring about an even greater sustainable or transmutational energy within our feeling process, because certainly we see feeling is the language of the soul, not thinking. Mm. And so if we bring these two vast possibilities together, that thought creates reality, but feeling actualizes the manifestation of our objectives, if we can become emotionally intelligent and mentally alert, we begin to desire expansion to a much richer potential, and that's exactly what's happening to us at this time.
So can I jump to this kind of statement? This is very simplistic, but I'm doing it on purpose. But sometimes I feel trapped in this body, but I feel the potential to move dimensions, to move in and out of my body. You see what I'm saying? And to go to different planetary structures, and I wonder about Gaia, whether she can also do this. Do we lose our physical structure, is what I'm saying, because we choose that?
Well, you know, there is something very extraordinary about Homo sapiens. We are unique in the cluster of soul identities mm-hmm. that exist within our galaxy. The angels teach me that we are one of 24 civilizations living within this galaxy.
Oh, wow, but really?
We are the only hominid. We are the only Homo sapien. The other beings do not have bodies. They can develop bodies through holographic processes, but they don't have bodies. So they look on us with awe. They look on us with awe because we live a constitutional biology on this planet, which is very different from any of the other planets. In other words, we're engaged in a cosmic experiment of bringing spirit into matter. And so therefore, rather than leaving our bodies, rather than ascending from our bodies, what I'm teaching everybody is to descend, is to bring spirit into matter. And once we have accomplished this, we become immensely powerful. Immensely magical as human beings, as spirit and matter, which means, of course, that automatically within our bodies we can move through Merkaba into interdimensional states that I'm already beginning to see ways of doing, or indeed are engaged in, when I go into ancient cultures where the biochemistry of the culture is not as toxic as living in the West. And I'm referring specifically to certain areas of Egypt that I go to, where I travel interdimensionally, but within my body.
Now, do you think the body also is like a file folder for our emotions? I often think of it that way. That's not all, but that's something I feel strongly, that our emotions are filed. Yes, go ahead. Sorry.
Feeling is the language of the soul. So I would have to say yes. But I believe you see that from a constitutional point of view, that there are two particular energies that keep our bodies alive that are absolutely fascinating, and most of us have little information about them. One is oxygen and the other is water. So what is it about the water molecule? Why is it that water is suddenly fascinating us? And that, you know, the work of Masaru Emoto brought us the miracle in water. So we will be able to begin to see the power of the crystalline structure of water, and how water can hold or transmute or transmogrify thought. The thought is a living energy.
And so, and emotion,
Which I'm coming to.
Okay.
And so what I'm believing, you know, what I'm being shown belief in through the experience of living on this planet and working interdimensionally with these angels, is that water as a molecular state is the greatest and most precise transmitter for the electromagnetic energy of feeling.
Aha. Uh-huh.
And that's why we associate water, or the water element, with our feeling state. That feeling is the language of the soul. It's just that we're very imbalanced, in the sense that particularly for the last 500 years, that we've had this fixation on the intellect.
Mm-hmm.
And so most of us just live in our heads. I'll give you a demonstration of this. You were referring to it in the early part of our conversation. But if we look at it bioenergetically, behaviorally, where most people live is in their heads. And so what I mean by this is that their voices are literally right up there. And if we go into the Northern American sound, which is getting even more cerebral and is becoming even more nasal, you know, we realize what that means. But if I actually change my voice energetically and go back to where I was, you can hear that there's a very specific shift in consciousness.
And yes, it's very strong, isn't it? Very good.
I'm living in my note. I'm living in my body. Our note is the song of our soul, you see, and it comes straight out of our heart. So you see, what I've done is to create a crucible of thought and feeling in response to your question, that it's about balancing the male and the female. The thinking is the male, the feeling is the feminine. Hmm. It's the sacred marriage. Mm-hmm. And once we do this, then that's when we begin to really open up a vast reservoir of potential that the majority of our brothers and sisters don't even have one inkling that they possess.
That's fascinating. You know, I just want to do a small aside, or it's not really an aside, but Stuart, you have been, I gather, quite an amazing actor. Hasn't acting brought you into the resonance to actually more than empathize, but actually experience the resonance of many different kinds of people? Isn't that one of the biggest gifts of acting?
Oh, sure. Yes. And, you know, I've learned more from serving great actors than I ever did as an actor. But, you know, I ceased acting in 1979, so that's a long time ago. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the wheel of destiny shifted, and I realized that I was being recognized by a powerful spiritual force in a way that I needed to revere. I needed to venerate myself to that potential. And it meant that I could move into service for the great actor and be an objectifying tool for the sensitivity and the sensate nature of the great actor, who, as you were implying, holds a mirror up to nature. And so, yeah, acting mirrors life.
Mm-hmm. That's a wonderful tool. I feel I know a lot of people from living in L.A. who are in the performance world, and there's something so consciousness-oriented if they approach it that way.
It's the actor's shaman, isn't it?
Really? Yes, it is. It's a brilliant tool.
And, you know, we see with those who are truly talented, and, you know, there are many, of course, who profess to, but there are very few who can. Mm-hmm. And they're very remarkable people. I mean by that the Mark Rylances, the Kate Blanchett's, the Emma Watson, you know, blah, 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 all these great, great, great actors that are around at the moment. And yes, they have remarkable conversations. They're immensely sensitive. Working with Cate Blanchett is like working with a thoroughbred racehorse. You know, it's the level of sensitivity and pedigree is just so rich. And the fact that they can transmogrify themselves so easily into being someone else.
I know, like Meryl Streep. I think a lot of us have her a bit on a pedestal for that. Do you know her? Have you worked with her?
I haven't, no. I know her. We know each other, but we haven't worked together. I was hoping that I would work on The Iron Lady when she did that, because Margaret was one of my first great clients, and indeed we remained in contact throughout the rest of our lives.
Was she a powerful, kind, sensitive person? What was she like?
Well, of course, I began with her at the beginning of her premiership, and she was one of the kindest people I know. Of course, as we know, the public image portrayed that she wasn't, that she became the Iron Lady. So something shifted in her consciousness. And I believe that, you know, when you're endowed with genius, as she was, that you need to be matched against other forces, other human forces without. And if they're constantly kowtowing to one, the genius sometimes reaches into a boundary of energy that is not always that gracious. And I have a feeling that that's what happened with her.
It sort of makes sense, doesn't it? I mean, it's logical that people would be pressured that way.
Yeah. And I've been fortunate, as I'm sure you have, of meeting and working with genies, you know, very remarkable human beings who have a certain prowess or a certain talent. And it's often seen as being God-given. And often they find it very difficult to be human. They find it very difficult to measure how it is to be sensate in the world that we're living in, when, quite frankly, many of us are not living in the right mind. And, you know, with genies, it's very often they're very sensitive. So they see this immediately and they feel in contradiction to what they're seeing on the outside. And as a result of that, they often become intemperate, they become angry, they become chaotic from a social point of view, or they become, as Howard Hughes did, they become reclusives, you know.
And of course, we live in, as you said, it's been an intellectually driven society for about 500 years, too. That doesn't leave that much room for being a very, very sensitive person living in your truth, right?
Yes, and you know what does intelligence mean? I mean, you know, in answer to the initial question that you gave me, I feel that what's happening at the moment is that we're fulfilling a different level of promise, meaning that we're moving from Homo sapiens, which means intelligence, into Homo noeticus, which means knowledge. And the only way that intelligence can become knowledge is if it's embodied through experience.
Right on.
And then the resonance of the individual shines forth a light of such vast radiation, as we see, for example, in His Holiness the Dalai Lama, or in the unfortunately retiring President of the United States, I mean by that Barack, who is evidently a very remarkable human being, and also the new, I'm just looking at the leaders that are around at the moment, the new Prime Minister of Canada, Justin Trudeau, who's just ravishing in his grace, embodied grace. So as we learn this embodied nature of intelligence, so we become truly wise, we dispatch our wisdom with infinite grace, and therefore we transmute onto another level, which is homo luminous, where we become truly enlightened, where literally every cell of our body, and we have, of course, in our bodies over 100 trillion cells, are in consort, in co-creativity, and in co-symphony with the universe, with the galaxy. So we become these immense light forces.
Well, now tell me, Stuart, is that the shift? Only is it much more elongated time-wise than we thought it would be. But is that the shift?
This is the shift, yeah. Mm-hmm. This is why.
I like the way you're delineating that. It sort of gives people something to not lean on, but, you know, it gives us some feeling of we're going somewhere, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And you know that chaos always precedes change.
Yeah.
And we're looking at our world and we're seeing a lot of chaos at the moment, particularly as you and I were sharing before we came on air, that we just moved through the inauguration of the 45th President of the United States. And when we look at it, we're in dismay. Why would this man become the president?
And why would millions and millions and millions and millions of people walk?
Yes, yes. And 3 million people walked yesterday.
Is that remarkable or what?
Three million women. And
a lot of men did too. I heard that.
Sure there were lots of brothers walking with the women as well. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I think it was just stabilized by nearly 3 million people. 3 million women. Which, you know, my math at this moment is not necessarily that resonant, but it only takes 11% of the population to change mass consciousness. So what's 11% of 7.5 billion people? Maybe we're moving into, is that 10 million?
I think we need
to keep marching, right?
Mm-hmm.
If 3 million people marched yesterday, if we keep marching, which evidently helped a tremendous amount of those people to express their frustration and dismay and disdain for this shadow figure that we've appointed as president, it seems that we may bring about vast change.
And I think also back to resonance of people, if you have people walking and marching and there's a tremendous solidarity, even if there's some disparate points of view, you know, they're not so opposite, but they might have some variation in there. It really is an awakening force in the vibrational fields of the planet, is it not?
Absolutely huge, because, of course, what we notice with this particular march is that it was heart-centered.
Mm-hmm.
And what we're learning radically is that the heart has an energy field 5,000 times greater than the human brain.
Isn't that something, huh?
So if we collectivize that level of consciousness, we're dealing with a mighty, mighty feeling-based machine.
And I felt, I didn't walk. I had a number of reasons not to actually go, but I attended in many ways. But one of the things I wanted to say is you have some wonderful YouTubes and you're bringing your angel relationship through to drawing a card. I wondered if you would give people at home the opportunity to hear some of your angel's perception of this time by drawing a card for us. Is that a possibility, Stuart?
It is indeed. Yes, in fact, I have the first oracle of two that the angels of Atlantis have produced through me. in front of me. So I'm just giving it a quick shuffle as we exchange energies through this immensely wonderful device called Skype.
Mm-hmm. It is great, isn't it?
It's just wonderful that here we are speaking and we're thousands and thousands of miles apart, and yet the transmission is so beautifully clear.
As you know, as an empath, there is no time and space anyway.
How amazing. Okay. So the card, what I did was to shuffle these 44 cards. 44 because 44 is the master number signifying spiritual purity and therefore was the master number of Atlantis. Mm. 44 so indicates 44 codons of DNA that are dormant in our bodies, but we're not living. So the oracle, in effect, is designed to awaken the usage of these 44 codons of DNA. And the card is Zadkiel. Zadkiel is the divine comforter angel that we discover in Kabbalah. Zadkiel is this beautiful teal or Larimar-colored orb. And the attribution for the card is security. So it's
wonderful. Now that's wonderful.
As a statement. Okay, now the teaching that flows forth from Zadkiel about security is, it starts off with a very bold statement. You've got it all wrong. The security that you believe in is a fixed point of reference. Security for you at the moment means something on the outside of you that ratifies your identity. Security at the moment is your role in the world, your profession in the world, how much money you have in your bank account, and how you fulfill the responsibilities of this. Security. How could I possibly be secure if I don't actually have status in society? That's where we're identifying at the moment. But actually what Zadkiel is saying is, you got it all wrong. That the true meaning of the word security in Latin is secure, self-cure.
Uh-huh.
So it's side of your being. It's not about what you're doing on the outside. It's who are you? It's this state that you, Veronica, referred to at least seven times during our conversation about the resonance frequency of the individual. How fascinating. We've been talking for 44 minutes.
Oh, wonderful.
There's significance there. And so what Zadkiel is doing is saying, please come back to the inner wisdom of the intuition of your soul, of the inner teacher of your soul, and stop living yourself out on the outside so aggressively. Stop doing, start being, and recognize that a way of doing this is to tune into your heart, because the heart is the seat of the soul, and allow the heart to become the dowsing mechanism for every single choice that you need to make, even down to the most elementary choice about what am I going to eat for lunch or dinner. What is your heart saying? And as soon as we do this, we move away from the limited parallel nature of shall I, shan't I, will I, won't I, which is what comes out of the brain. The ego device of the brain is always arguing with itself. If we come into the heart, we feel we truly know what is secure. And so we become much more emotionally intelligent, because why would we want to live something that feels uncomfortable? Why would we want to live something that gives us pain? Why would we want to live something that limits us? Why would we want to live something that is a constant compromise for our virtue? No, what we do is we give up whatever that is, whether it's a dysfunctional relationship, both personally or professionally, and we move into the solidarity of our own union and communion with the divine, which is what true security is. In Latin, is secure. I often like to look at the Alpha and the Omega, the top card and the bottom card of the, you know, this 44 cards oracle, because we can see the beginning and the ending. The beginning of the notion that Zadkiel has just shared with us, which is learning about true security, to understand how we can pitch ourselves up against alongside life at this time, when a lot of it seems to be quite challenging. And the card that comes up is Raziel. Now, Raziel is a fascinating angel. Raziel is the angel of the mysteries. And the attribution for the card is intuition, that the way in is to understand, the way into future progression and fulfilling the prophecy of what it is to be a Homo sapien at this time living on planet Earth, is to really go deep into the intuition of our species, the intuition of our inner intelligence. But we're living too much on the outside of ourselves by doing. And what we need to do is to balance the doing with being, so that we do be. You see, Scooby-Doo.
Yeah. But actually, it's really interesting because that requires a huge shift all throughout, resonating throughout the entire species, doesn't it?
Yeah, it means very simply that we need to stop giving our power away and start meditating. As soon as we start meditating, our intuition begins. Our intuition wakens and gives us fundamental information.
That's so true. That's the best place to go for your answers, isn't it?
I mean, these things are so simple. We make life so complex. It's very, very simple. People say to me, oh my God, you make it so simple. Well, love is all there is. So why would we want to do anything else?
Tell me, what is love? That's a big question.
Love is a very, very high level of vibration that emanates from the love light circuitry, which is at the very core of the galactic heart. So it's a vibration. It's not a feeling. It's a vibration that downloads into what we know is a feeling state. So it is the ultimate purity. It is the absolute resonance of truth. And it is taught to us very primarily by the divine feminine principle, which is not about doing, it's just about being. You know, after I met the angels in 1987, they introduced me to some very interesting beings, and a group of beings came to me that call themselves ultra-terrestrial. They're called the Hathors.
Oh, the Hathors. Like,
because we know in ancient Egypt there's the goddess Hathor, who is the goddess of beauty and the goddess of love. So they come from another galaxy. They use Venus to wing in on, because apparently Venus has a very powerful electromagnetic charge for them. And they come to teach us about how we need to become more emotionally intelligent, because feeling is the language of the soul. So they gave me a lot of information, but their parting shot to me was this. That they said very firmly, we want you to get this, so listen loudly. We have been on a trajectory much longer than Homo sapien, and our intelligence has evolved, because everything is evolving every second, every nanosecond within the universe, within the galaxy, within the cosmos. Nothing is static. Everything is constantly evolving. You are from an infinitely unfolding creative potential full of love and joy. This you call heaven. What we want to impart to you is that way we have moved, you are now also moving. Except we have something different, which you are beginning to learn, and that is that ecstasy is our lowest feeling state.
Oh my,
for you.
Oh my.
So you see, joy is potentially sustainable. We do not need to live the dualistic splendor of joy, woe, joy, woe, joy, woe, joy, woe. We are beginning to understand that there is a consistency and a sustainability in joy. And so we move from a double helix into a triple helix, and therefore we become space beings again.
What started us off being so limited? What was the fall from the Garden of Eden, if that's the right metaphor?
Well, if anything moves away from source, it begins to limit itself.
Right, okay.
It begins to limit itself to try and identify itself, even though it has already identified itself as being a magical proportional energy of the source. But if it denies the source, then automatically the ego needs to define itself and give it an identity. And, you know, for many, many thousands of years, we've been trying to do that. And look at the mess that we've made.
Oh, my goodness.
Now, the thing is that we're coming back into, you know, having gone through through the revolution of the scientific invention of the universe, we're now coming back to where we were 500 years ago, where everybody believed in the force, where everybody believed in pranayama, where everybody believed in God's breath, or as they called it, the anima mundi. So we're now coming back to realize, hey, my breath is really important. In fact, it's the core inspirational witness of my being. Maybe I need to spend a few moments each day really breathing deeply. And so we seek out places where we can do that. If we have emotional intelligence, that's what we do. Because after all, it was the very first thing that we achieved as we shot out of our mother's birth canals, the breath, and then the sound.
So it's through the breath and the sound that we will achieve liberation or freedom, however you put it. Is that right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, you know, this is why sound is at the core of creation. You know, wherever we go, whatever culture, but let's stay within Western culture. And if we reach into the Old Testament, it said, and God said, let there be light, and there was light. Mm-hmm. You know, and God asked Adam to name all of the things in the garden. And everything took on its own identity, so it had a sonic code, which we call a word or a syllable. At the beginning of the fourth gospel, it says, in the beginning was the... Actually, what does it say? Because I know it in translation. I met an Aramaic scholar many years ago who said that the original translation or the original words were, in the beginning was sound, and the sound was made flesh and dwelt among us full of grace and truth. But of course, we say, in the beginning was the word, and the word is the logos. The logos is the intelligibility of sound, which we see as word. What fixates us is the fact that we're very literate. So we see words as these sonic glyphs that we write with. Mm-hmm. And in fact, words are purely sound transmissions.
So how would you work with, this is sort of a fascinating thing to me, that say you've got somebody who's talking like that all the time and you want to work with them to open their soul, their potential and so on. How do you work with people? Is it like being an instrument, teaching people we're like instruments and take the capo off? Or how do you do that?
If I may, I would just need to reverse your question and say, well, it's not me who wants to change the person. It's the person who wants to change themselves. So they can't, you know, if somebody's talking like that, you know what I'm saying? Yeah. And they're racism, and then, you know, then it's not me. Oh, by God, you know, what are you doing? Your nasality is awful. I mean, that's not my style. They come to me. And so therefore, there is a desire for change. And the desire for change often comes out of gross disempowerment. So there is a desire for change. So to begin with, a gentle conversation is opened up to look at the other possibilities of, well, if we release this nasality, the nasality that we produce is purely produced by a muscle lifting very high. So in other words, I'll stop doing it. The back of the tongue is lifting very high against the soft palate muscle at the roof of the mouth. And when it lifts high, you get a lot of nasality. So the jaw gets very tight and everything goes into that sort of constriction, okay? But if we release it, which is what I'm doing, then automatically it begins to free up. So the first thing is to listen into the desire for that person to want to change. And what do they want to change into? And then one begins to open up a conversation quite organically about why they feel constricted. Because as soon as we feel constricted, our body always reflects constriction and therefore also is a co-creator in that restriction. And the first thing that goes is the jaw gets very tight. Mm-hmm. So, and it's often to do the fact that the lips become like curtains drawn, meaning that we have been prohibited from expressing the real core values of our being by indomitable parents or systems that have been authoritative and have not allowed us to be the people that we want to be. We're constantly having to be the people that other people want us to be. Mm-hmm. We constrict the whole of our bodies. We use tension to close off areas of our bodies because we don't want to feel. Because feeling makes us feel very awkward and uncomfortable and diseased.
That's so true, because we're so, I think it's called controlled by what is expected of us. I think of it as incarcerated sometimes.
Yeah, I believe you're absolutely right. We're imprisoned, we're incarcerated. Now we're beginning to realize that we are not only are we incarcerated, but we're also the jailers of our own prisons, and that we do have a key. We do have a key, or we do have explosive devices to get out of that prison.
I like the explosive devices, that's funny.
Love is the most expansive explosive device that we have.
So love, you would bring it down, you would open up to receive it and call it in, would you not? I mean, it doesn't just come because you want to grab something and say, I love peanut butter, which I think some of us do, right?
Well, I mean, yeah, we love the sensual pleasures of life. It's just that are we in balance with that? Because I love cheese, so I'm going to spend the rest of the day eating nothing but cheese. But I don't think, at the end of it, we'll probably feel rather sickly. So we use our intelligence to balance out proportion. And life really is a question of learning proportion, isn't it? That's really what it's
Well,
all
and the
about.
reason I asked you what love is because it's a word that's bandied about all the time, but you and I know it's what connects the whole universal expansion, and I want us to be able to really call it in and feel it.
I mean, one of the things that fascinated me about my the early stages of the work in my self-discovery of my own being and how I could help others was the nature of the heart, because evidently in all cultures the heart is seen as the seat of the soul. Ancient Egypt, as we know, considered the heart as being the prime organ. That the brain that we consider to be the prime organ was just ripped out at the point of death and destroyed, whereas the heart was taken as a vessel of the totality of truth and love within that individual and was weighed in the great halls of Maat, the goddess of truth, against the weight of a feather. And in fact, still today, we talk about my heart is as light as a feather. And in the ancient system of truth, the goddess Maat would weigh our heart against the feather. If the heart was heavier than the feather, it meant that we lived a life of corruption. And so a creature called Amut would come and gobble our heart
Oh my
up, and we were
goodness.
dead forever. But if the heart was as light as lighter than the feather, we were met by the king god Osiris and taken by his hand into paradise. And so everybody lived with this information. Everybody lived to be as pure within their hearts as they possibly could. And of course, as we all know, that the very first feeling state that awakens, electrifies, amplifies, and gives proportion to our heart is love.
Boy, that's sure true. Now tell me this. This is just a thought that flashed through my head was in the days of Egypt, when they were concerned with the heart being lighter, just as you just expressed, did they have practitioners that actually helped lighten people's heart when there was a time of what, criminal behavior or family problems or whatever? Did they actually focus on that as a healing tool?
Well, absolutely, yes. But
And did they use sound for that?
they were using sound and color and light therapy in very extensive ways, yes, because they knew that these energies were at the very core of creation. So I believe that their lives, all that I've discovered is that their lives were a constant reminder of the verities of life. So they were constantly moving themselves into a state of purity, physically, emotionally, mentally, and
They
spiritually.
were a little
They
more
had a presence.
beyond us, I think, in that sense, right? It isn't a linear. Okay, let's go to one of the pyramids. Tell me about sound and the pyramids and healing.
They were spiritually more adept,
Okay.
certainly. Yeah.
Yeah.
But look, I mean, the introduction to in the mechanistic view of the scientific view of the universe was huge when it was introduced 400 years ago by Isaac Newton. And we literally unplugged from a thought form that human beings, particularly within medieval Europe, had been living for thousands of years. It's all quantifiable, but at the same time, to say that one system is better than the other, I try not to. It just is what it is. What I do know is that they used an honor code,
Okay.
and that this honor code were a system of 12 graces, and these 12 graces have permeated through the existence of the majority of the civilizations that we now refer to as being the origins of Western thought. And I mean by that Lemuria, I mean by that Atlantis, I mean by that Egypt, Mesopotamia, Sumeria, I mean by that Greece and Rome. And these verities or graces are very simple. There are 12 in all, and they are love, truth, joy, piety or devotion, humility, faith, mercy, wisdom, loyalty, courage, justice, and victory. That these essential precepts are the adhesion that have kept emotional intelligence developing and always reaching into a state of ultimate and absolute purity through the trajectory that we refer to as being human civilization.
And that's ancient, is it not, that list?
Oh, it's ancient, mm-hmm. ancient.
That's wonderful. Yeah. So I, in my interruption a few minutes ago, I was asking if you could also take us through something in a pyramid about the way the sound moves through a pyramid and how it amps itself up to have a huge impact on people, does it not?
Well, the pyramids were constructed through sound, and so they are material vessels of pure oscillating, vibrating sound. Yeah, so they look solid, but they're constantly moving. And so each aspect of their fabric, whether it be solid or chamber-like, each aspect of their fabric is a resonance field or resonance frequency or a resonance chamber. So for example, you know, for many, many years I've been conducting rituals in the King's Chamber, which for me is one of the most remarkable, if not one of the most prima facie chambers in the world for extraordinary supernal acoustic.
Wow, I'd love to be there at some point.
Well, you must come. You must come when we're doing ritual.
You better tell people about how you run these, or you take people on retreat to the pyramids or to Egypt.
Yes, I run a series of retreats, but the one that's most specific is the Resurrection Retreat, which is very, very popular because literally it's 10 days of retreat through the supernal star chambers of ancient Egypt. We go to the key ones and some that are slightly off the beaten track but are still immensely alive. I work with a remarkable friend and Egyptologist who is an Egyptian called Ashraf Amin, who is a wonderful Egyptologist whisperer. So he whispers everybody into shape and therefore everybody loves Ashraf. So we gain entrance into some very remarkable places that are completely off the beaten track. And the Resurrection Retreat in essence is that we literally, as we journey through, we die to our old selves. We die to all of the negativity of our old selves and are reborn or resurrected into our divine blueprint. So through each of the chambers that we go through, there are rituals and initiations until we finalize in the King's Chamber of the Great Pyramid, which is where the pharaohs would go for the process of what they refer to as being ossification, where they would literally transmute any of the crustaceans within or without that they had developed to do with negative thought or negative feeling and continuously aspire or indeed ascend through what we call the Kundalini awakening into the process of being at one with the divine, being literally being an asu, which was being a shining one. So they became human angels.
Hmm. Now, have you gone through that process, Stuart?
Have
you gone through that for the resurrection process? Have you gone through it yourself?
I'm consistently going through it, yes.
Well,
yes.
How does it impact your life? Does it feel cleansed, absolutely cleansed, or do you feel ascended, or how do you feel when you go through it?
Feel more in love.
Ah, that's the best. That's the top of it all.
And so life for me becomes co-creative and not co-dependent. Life for me becomes richly stimulated by the fact that I recognize I'm a universal sounding board in the cosmos of sound. It allows me to meet extraordinary people like Veronica, who I can talk about these wonderful, wonderful life-enhancing, life-empowering, life-realizing forces so that we literally become very remarkable in the radiation of our luminescence. It shows me many, 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 many things. It allows me to stay calm in a world of turmoil. Mm-hmm. I don't always achieve that, but I achieve it at least 95% of the time. Sometimes I make terrible mistakes because we're all fallible. And the opportunity, of course, is just simply to recognize what those mistakes are and then to take again and not give up. And so it allows me to live a trajectory of, I guess, something that we human beings call success. And I define success as sustainable joy.
That's wonderful. That's wonderful. And now we're going to have to draw to a close, and I really hate to let you go because we've only just nudged the edges of some of your talents and some of your accesses to greater consciousness, for which I'm deeply honored. But would you like to speak just for a minute about your books and your cards and that sort of thing and how people can be in touch with you?
Yes, thank you. Thank you. My website is www.stuartpearce.com, and the spelling of that is StewartPearce, StuartPearce.com. There is also a second website, which is the angelsofatlantis.com, which is a temple site. It's non-commercial, but just provides lots of information about the 12 angels of Atlantis with wonderful prayers and meditations and affirmations and, you know, self-enhancing processes. I've written a number of books, the first being The Alchemy of Voice, which is the core work that the angels gave me over the years.
That's a fascinating subject.
It's sound used as a transmutational vehicle, yes. Sound is the medicine of the future, there is no doubt. There is no doubt.
Great.
As we know, ultrasound is being used. However, I could go on and on and on about that.
Well, then you'll come back and go on a little more one day.
Okay, mm-hmm.
Let's do it.
Then there, of course, are the oracles, which are absolutely amazing, particularly the first oracle, which has been translated into 12 different languages. And there are many audio recordings, which are largely my voice taking people through meditative processes or life-enhancing processes, rather like the two that I referred to earlier. Well, certainly I refer to the Angel So-Calls. And another recording, which has become an international bestseller, which is the Angelic Om Healing, which is my voice chanting the Om.
Oh, I was listening to that before this particular interview, and I told somebody else, you have to listen to this. It's amazing.
Well, thank you, darling. And the 12 angels come through on the sound, you see. Oh. So it just feels so enhancing, doesn't it?
I felt love. People might want to know that, right?
Beautiful.
Yes.
Beautiful.
So I have to say goodbye as much as I don't want to. And it's been an utter delight and also very, very expansive to speak with you, Stuart. I'm really honored by the time you've shared with us.
Well, thank you so much. It's been an absolute joy to meet a kindred spirit. And so thank you for being so beautifully open and honoring of the work. Wow. It's my life passion. So it's the greatest joy to speak. Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you. And this is Veronica Entwistle saying, you've listened to Paradigm Shifter. Be in touch, veronicaentwistle.com. And Stuart's interview will be out on podcasts as well on my site, veronicaentwistle.com, on Speak Up Talk Radio, on iTunes, Stitcher, and perhaps even on your site, Stuart.
Yes, absolutely, unquestionably, and on Facebook, and on Twitter, and on.
Yes, so it's easy to catch up with us. Many, many blessings, everyone, and many blessings back to you, Stuart.
Namaste to everybody, including you, my darling.
Okay, namaste to you, too. Bye.